on the ground, there was this wooden, it's about this long, it's like a triangle. And it turns out it was a doorstop, like a wooden wedge that you would stick under the bathroom door, probably to clean it. And there was blood on it. Turns out this doorstop was used to sexually assault her.
I was wondering if you were going to bring that up. That is one of the most horrifying aspects of a case that I think I've ever heard.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun, dun, dun.
What is shaking, crime crew? Murder Unscripted, episode 87. Coming at you like a true crime freight train.
Yikes.
Yeah, look out. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, joined as always by the one and only Melissa Spivey.
What's up? Wow, episode 87? Really? That is wild.
I know. Nuts.
Like, I don't really keep track. I only know the numbers when you tell me what they are, and it blows my mind every time.
Harder than you think. We should call this episode, "What's That Episode Number?"
Yeah, seriously.
That's the real mystery.
Call it that from now on. Well, we are in the third week of January, which means we are continuing our Fresh Starts block that we did for this month. Mm-hmm. And last episode, we covered the batshit case of Kim Long and also the murder of Oswaldo or Ozzie Condi. I mean, mm-hmm. he was the victim. And ultimately, we don't have any justice for him. Kim went to prison for years and years that she shouldn't have been there.
Right.
Well, this week we are going to continue on and we're actually going to go deeper into the world of junk science and false convictions.
Junk science is a perfect name for what you're about to hear. And this story hits, I'm not sure there's one that hits closer to home than this one, because the case that we're going to cover today, I was an associate producer on the show Forensic Files back in 2003, and this was literally the first case in my true crime career. Like, it's the case that actually just, I started as a production assistant where I was out on set and doing like recreation stuff with the team. And then they learned that I could write. So I came in and I wrote this first pitch. It was called Once Bitten, was the name of the episode. That was my first experience writing mystery, writing a story that had some suspense.
It's the one that started it all.
Yeah, kind of is. And here we are.
Like, literally, yeah.
Yeah, God.
Well, guys, that means you can go watch this episode, for the Forensic Files episode. What did you say it's called? Once Bitten?
Once Bitten, yep.
All right, well, go check it out.
There's an exciting part to it, and that's the fact that the man at the center of this story is coming on as a guest next week, and his name is Ray Crone, and we obviously exchanged some messages and emails to get to this point, to get him on the show, but the last time I actually spoke with him was in 2003, so needless to say, this reunion is 22 plus 23 years in the making.
I cannot wait for that conversation, and I'm excited to hear his story today, because I don't know this case super well. Like, I know the big picture, but I don't know a lot of the little details.
Yeah.
But real quick, before we dive in, just a little housekeeping. If you like what you're hearing from Murder Unscripted, please consider leaving us a review on Apple or Spotify. Those 5-star reviews mean more than you know to the growth of our podcast. Like,
yes,
they're so important.
They are.
Also, reminder that we launched our Patreon earlier this month. So if you'd like to hear a few more cases and score a few bonus perks, please consider joining. And actually, 20% of all Patreon proceeds are going to a really amazing cause that we are not ready to tell you about, but soon. But trust us, they're incredible. And we are so excited to hopefully be working with them.
Yeah, because otherwise, I feel like when you just say it's like a mystery cause, that could be anything. It could be Melissa's PetSmart budget. It could be anything.
Exactly. Okay, well, if you want to donate to that, hit me up, because I could use donations. My dogs would love you.
And fun fact, last night's Patreon recording went totally off the rails when boozy milkshakes were introduced. So
yeah, it was entertaining.
We're recording this morning and I'm moving a little slow.
for our Patreons, I'm going to post our boozy milkshake recipes on Patreon.
So you it's guys so can, good, guys.
Like, so good.
This set the bar for milkshakes.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah, I will say that this morning's a little bit rough recording after last night.
This water cannot end. It needs to be like an IV of just water.
That's what I know. I know I have like so much to drink. I've got like my 40 ounce Stanley.
Water would be nice. All right, y'all, with that out of the way, let's dive into today's case. And I will set the stage by telling you that it literally has everything. So we have a brutal murder, incredibly flawed forensic science, and a man that was sentenced to death. And you heard me correctly, not just sentenced to jail time. He was sentenced to death for a crime that he didn't commit. And ultimately, one of the most dramatic DNA exonerations in American history. And at the center of it all is something that sounds like it belongs in a B-movie, a B-horror movie, and that's bite mark evidence, which is referred to in the field as forensic odontology. And the press nicknamed Ray Krohn the snaggletooth killer because of he had some crooked teeth. It was an awful characterization that followed him for over a decade while he sat in prison on death row.
The media loves to name people, like they love those catchy nicknames, don't they? Like,
yeah,
even though it is so mean and like he didn't do anything wrong. Like, they're just like, I'll just name him, whatever.
Yeah. And I think it, again, shows why the victim can get lost in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So let's travel back to Phoenix, Arizona, in the final days of 1991. The city was still basking in the afterglow of the holiday season. Everyone in town was preparing for the New Year's Eve celebration. And at a little neighborhood bar on West Camelback Road, there was a young woman named Kim Ancona, who was working on what would be her final shift. So the CBS Bar, Restaurant, and Lounge sat at 1615 West Camelback in Phoenix, and it was one of those classic neighborhood bars. Like, it was really, I wouldn't call it a dive bar, but it was just kind of a place where you felt at home, where everybody knew your name, where regulars had, like, their bar stools. You were treated like family. You knew the staff. You knew the owner. That kind of place.
Like Cheers, but in the Arizona desert.
Yeah, exactly right. So the bar was owned by a man named Hank Arredondo, and his bar manager was 36-year-old Kimberly Ann Ancona, though everybody called her Kim. Like we experienced with Carol Armstrong, finding details about these victims is always the hardest part of researching these exoneration cases because, as we've talked about, the story lies in the exoneration, and the victim often takes a back seat, which is so sad.
Yeah, I feel like the victims literally become like afterthoughts or footnotes in their own stories.
It's awful. And what's interesting, and this is something just like a little side note. So when we did the forensic files, we did it in 2003. The ending of this case wasn't long before that. So we kind of were some of the first people to bring it into the spotlight. That being said, we did not have the cooperation of the police department, which you will see why in a second.
Well,
yeah. So we did have we had enough people to put the story together. But the point is, another show came out just a couple years ago, and that show did have the cooperation of the police department. And it was so special for me to watch because the production was fine. It wasn't anything like earth shattering or monumental. It was another crime show. But for me, there were pictures in there that I had never seen. So like in your mind, you get like, I have the Ray Krohn case in my head a certain way because it's all I know about the case. So to see new pictures of a case that I thought I knew was incredible.
That is really cool.
So what we learned about Kim Ancona, and this is from my show, from the new show, all these things. So she was known to her friends and kind of local regular bar patrons as Kimmy. And she had worked as a cocktail waitress and a bartender at various locations around the neighborhood for about 8 years. So back in 1991, a regular patron of the CBS Lounge named Gary Horton, he told the Arizona Republic that Kim lived in Phoenix with her boyfriend and she had three children, one of whom had just turned 10 years old on December 28th, which was the day before the murder. Can you imagine? Like, her child's birthday was the day before and then the next day, something's going to happen.
That is devastating. Like, a mom of three, she's someone's girlfriend. And from what I hear about her, she sounds like a great employee. She was someone who showed up to work every day for 8 years. And like, these are the little details we need. These are the little details that humanize the victims. And they're always the hardest ones to find.
Yeah, it is a fact. Well, Horton described Kim to the reporters as someone who was loved by everyone. He said, quote, "It's just a shame. She had no enemies, at least not that we were aware of," end quote. And you're going to hear me quoting a lot because I wanted to bring, for me, one of the best ways to bring a story to put you in the time and place that this happened is to go to old newspaper articles and hear quotes from people that were there that day instead of just rehashing the same old story that everybody tells.
Yeah.
Hank Arredondo, he was the bar owner that we talked about. He echoed this sentiment. So he told reporters that in the bar business, quote, "You have to have a nice personality, you have to be honest, and all of those qualities Kim had," end quote.
So by all accounts, she was well-liked, good at her job, like nothing is standing out as a red flag.
No red flags whatsoever. So December 28th, 1991, it was a Saturday night, and Kim was closing up the CBS lounge. And as he normally did, Hank Arredondo would call the bar around 11:15 just to check in, make sure everything went okay that night and that closing was going fine.
That's actually really thoughtful. Like, I feel like a lot of bar owners or managers just, they wouldn't care that much.
Right. Well, Hank was definitely protective of his staff and not so much of the guy we're going to talk about soon, but we'll get there. So we had interviewed Hank for the Forensic Files episode. And at the time he told us that Kim said everything was okay, that things were kind of slow that night and that she was perfectly fine closing by herself. And she went on to say, like, "Hank, I know you're tired. Go to sleep, get some rest. I'll take care of it." So I don't know if he would come in if she needed to, but it sounded like he was a half decent owner, not the best man, which we'll get to, but a good owner. So, and those were the last words that Hank Arredondo would ever hear from Kim Ancona.
Wow.
So the following morning, which was Sunday, December 29th, 1991, Hank arrived at the CBS lounge at his usual time to open up. But immediately, something felt off. The front door was completely unlocked.
That, we know, is a never a good sign.
Correct. So you could imagine that Hank's mind obviously immediately went to money. Like, this is some kind of robbery that happened overnight. So he checks the bar's safe first, but none of the cash was missing. And then he kind of surveys the kitchen. Everything seems in order. He checks the office. Everything's fine. But then he walks into the men's restroom. And what Hank Arredondo saw when he opened the door would haunt him for the rest of his life. So he told reporters at the time, quote, "It was just horrible. Something you just can't forget. I saw her laying in the bathroom, her eyes fixed, dead. I can still remember to this day, and I probably will remember for the rest of my life. But this girl was beautiful even in death," end quote.
Oh, that is so haunting. But like, you can definitely tell how much it affected him just by that statement alone.
Oh, yeah, with good reason. I mean, and when I'll put pictures up, but you'll see this is not an everyday scene.
Wow.
So Hank calls police, Phoenix PD arrives, and what they find told a brutal story. So Kim had been stabbed repeatedly, and an autopsy later revealed that she'd been stabbed multiple times in the chest and back, including a fatal wound that penetrated her lung. And that came from the back. That was the fatal wound by her spine. So, but there was also evidence of sexual assault, like her jeans were laying next to her body. Her body did show signs of significant trauma, including bite marks on her left breast and neck. And these bite marks would play the biggest part in the entire story and ruin a man's life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a Phoenix spokesperson did tell the Arizona Republic that Ancona did, she received trauma to her head and neck or both, and was obviously the victim of foul play. So they knew this was a homicide right off the bat. I mean, that was pretty clear.
So they know it's like sexual assault and murder, but did they find evidence there?
They did. And this is an example of something that I learned. I just learned this last week, and it is so messed up because, so I watched that other production, the newer one that was done on this case, and there'd always been this piece of something in one of the crime scene photos that I didn't pay much attention to because I didn't think it played a role in the case. But when the detectives brought it up, and again, this came from not having the police cooperation on the Forensic Files episode, but on the ground, there was this wooden, it was about this long, it was like a triangle, and it turns out it was a doorstop, like a wooden wedge that you would stick under the bathroom door, probably to clean it. And there was blood on it. But I just thought it was something that was on the floor during the murder. Turns out this doorstop was used to sexually assault her, which is horrifying.
I was wondering if you were going to bring that up. That is one of the most horrifying aspects of a case that I think I've ever heard.
It's awful. Yeah. And imagine just learning it. Like, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think it was relevant to the story. We just knew she was sexually assaulted.
Right. Well,
and here's where it gets kind of dark. So the evidence suggested that the killer had grabbed a gigantic kitchen knife from the kitchen and then forced Kim into the men's restroom where she was attacked. And after the murder, he placed the knife in a trash can. So police are rooting through the area. They pull out the bag of the trash can and under the bag in the plastic, the bottom of the trash can was this knife. So they found it right there. The killer just tried to like stash it under there.
What a weird thing to do.
Well, he maybe figured like Who's going to look under the liner?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, and on his way out, the killer, whoever did this, he left a gigantic shoe print on the freshly cleaned kitchen floor. And it's one of my favorite types of scientific evidence ever. Like when experts identify that this print came from a Converse brand sneaker size 9.5. I love shoe print analysis. When they're we have this pattern and they have to figure out what shoe this came from. And then they try to connect someone to this shoe. It's awesome.
We should do a whole block on like shoes.
Yeah.
Like feet.
Footprint. I don't know what we call it.
There's an amazing Forensic Files episode where the perp jumps out the window and he lands on a tomato.
That was mine too. Quite a spectacle.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. It was a wrestler.
The glasses. Yes.
Canadian wrestler. Yeah. Quite a how about that name? Quite a spectacle.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
See, I know my Forensic Files.
I did 65 Forensic Files. So there's a good chance that some of them are mine. Well, there were also several foreign hairs found on Kim's body. And these hairs were black and clearly did not belong to Kim. I mean, Kim had dark hair, but these were like different. You could tell. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the most unusual piece of evidence was what I mentioned earlier, that bite mark. Like it looked like the killer had bitten through Kim's tank top and left an impression on her skin. So Kim's tank top was covered in stab wounds, but also you could see where someone bit through it and got her.
A bite mark is so, I feel like, unusual. To me, it's just so personal. Like maybe it could be a domestic violence situation or someone that was just so angry and full of rage. But I also feel like the biting can be like a weird sexual fetish too.
It could be any or all of those things. They're all absolutely reasons that someone would bite somebody else during an attack.
Ugh.
Well, and I'm sure our incredibly savvy listeners can guess that this bite mark would turn out to be very significant, like more significant when I say that, like the linchpin in the entire story. And actually, before we move on, I want to say something else that I just learned. So police, Kim's body was kind of wedged behind the door. It's almost to the point where you couldn't open it fully. So in order to properly process this crime scene, detectives took the door off the hinge. So they went in and carefully removed the pins to take the door off. But they also had to be careful then because any like schmutz, for lack of a better word, dust, debris that's on the door would fall into the crime scene and maybe jeopardize it. So they carefully removed this door so that they could get a clear view of the crime scene.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't think about that. That something like that would cause, like schmutz, good word, just to fall down.
That's what I could think of. But anything, any dirt or anything on the door.
Mm-hmm.
So as they move kind of out back into the bar area, they noticed that there were also two. So all the stools are up. So clearly she had closed the bar, but there were two drinks that were sitting there, like right on the bar, which meant Kim, those had been poured after closing time. And that was a huge clue because it suggested that Kim may have known her attacker, that she let someone in after hours, which was against company policy, but it might have been a buddy that she was like, yeah, come have a drink.
Yeah.
So forensic scientists found Kim's fingerprints on one of the glasses, and the other glass had prints, but they weren't clear enough for identification. There were also these unknown fingerprints found in the men's restroom, which didn't match Kim and couldn't immediately be identified. And they're going to come into play too.
All right. So we got a shoe print. We have foreign hairs, we have unknown fingerprints, we have the bite mark, and we kind of have the evidence showing that our victim knew her attacker. So I feel like we have a lot to work with.
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you?
Would
sure sounds
so.
That way.
Yeah.
Well, robbery did not appear to be the motive. So we talked about that because no money was missing from the bar and none was missing from Kim's purse. So I think that immediately tells police that there was something in the bite mark, that this was a sexual frenzy that went on.
Mm-hmm.
But inside Kim's purse, police do find something that would change the entire trajectory of this investigation, and that's an address book. And in that address book was the name and telephone number of one of the bar's regular patrons, a postman named Ray Crone.
I don't understand this. He wasn't the only name in there.
It was because of the stuff you're going to learn, what I'm going to tell you in a second.
Okay.
So in December of 91, Raymond Milton Crone was 34 years old. He was an Air Force veteran who was honorably discharged and had absolutely zero prior criminal record. And he was actually a mail carrier for the U.S. Postal Service, delivering mail around Phoenix. And by all accounts, he was a regular guy living a regular life.
So, like, why is it such a big deal that he's in our address book?
So, So he was a regular customer at the CBS Lounge. He lived in the neighborhood, and he would stop by, he would socialize. He was really there to play darts. Like, that's where he would go. It was his local hometown bar. And he would have a few beers, get together with buddies, no big deal. And he was also in a volleyball league. They would often go, like after practice, they would go to the CBS Lounge. So he had known Kim casually through the bar, but here's where things get complicated because some of the bar's employees had told police that Kim had expressed romantic interest in Ray and that she'd mentioned wanting to get to know him better because maybe she was hoping something could develop between them. And this is a very fuzzy story that I'm hoping Ray can clear up next week.
And I also feel like, though, sometimes as a bartender, you're like, oh, he's cute. Like, oh, the cute regular. Like, that's just what you call someone. Like, it doesn't mean you want to, like, get with them. It just means, like,
that's it.
You know, oh, the cute guy who orders the Stella Artois, whatever. Like,
yeah, totally. That's
the first beer that came to mind.
Well, I definitely want to remember to ask Ray because I think it would help to have his clarity on the situation.
Well, the other question I have is, didn't she have a boyfriend? We said that at the beginning.
She did, and three kids. So, like, obviously, yeah. Ray is an upstanding dude. And I know we're going to paint, like, police at least are going to paint him as a demon, devil from hell, but he's not. So ignore what you're going to hear about him. But yeah, he didn't want anything. He knew she had a relationship. She lived with the guy. So he wasn't out, in my opinion, he was not out for anything more than that. So this would have just been hearsay at the bar. But here's the problem, because a few witnesses told police that Kim actually had a date planned with Ray that night, like when she was murdered, that he was supposed to come by and help her close up the bar.
Which would explain the two glasses at the bar. Yeah, that like we think was poured after hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when police questioned Ray Crone, he had a completely different story. And this is the accurate story. So when you meet Ray, you're going to be like, this guy's a straight shooter. He's honest. He's polite. He's very, he'll tell you the truth. He said that he and Kim were merely acquaintances, but he did acknowledge that he liked her, but in a completely platonic sense. He said, quote, she was always nice. She was a congenial person and very friendly and outgoing. And so, you know, I liked her personality. I liked her bubbliness and things like that, end quote. But again, Ray denied there was any romantic relationship. I want to make that abundantly clear. And he also denied that he had any plans with Kim that night to close the bar or any other plans.
So he's contradicting what the witnesses are saying. They're saying something totally different.
He totally is. But here's the thing. Ray had an alibi. So he shared a house with a coworker who confirmed that Ray was home the entire night of December 28th, like never left the house. I think he like bounced around the house a little bit, different room to room. But I mean, he never left. So he was home the night Kim was murdered.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, I mean, I don't know how close he was with his roommate, but like, would the roommate really cover for him? Like, that's a big cover when there's a murder involved. Like, that's a big thing to lie for someone for their alibi.
Yeah, exactly right. So, well, here's what sealed Ray's fate. So police come and they question him. They just show up one day. He's in the house and they're like banging on the door. And they notice something about his teeth. So the front left tooth kind of protruded slightly from the others. And I'll put a picture up so you can see Ray's bite and the bite mark and all the other things. But like it jutted forward beyond the line of his front teeth. So basically just stuck out a little bit. And to the investigators, it looked very similar to the bite pattern they found on Kim Ankota's body.
We can see where this is going.
Yeah. Well, and notice I stressed the word similar because I agree. They look really damn similar. Well, police ask Ray if he'd be willing to provide an impression of his teeth. And they basically hand him a cup. And Ray, because he was innocent and had nothing to hide, he literally takes the cup, bites into it, chomps down like nothing. Like, why wouldn't he?
Why wouldn't he? He didn't do anything wrong. You're taught to be... You know, you're taught that police are good and they're there to help you. And
right.
He thinks he's helping, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I will mention that bite impressions were obtained from other men who knew Kim Ankona, but the only one of them that had this distinctive extended left front tooth was the impression that belonged to Ray Crone. And forensic scientists who also analyzed the saliva found on Kim's clothing. And this is 91. So DNA testing was, But it, they were round, but it was inconclusive. What they did have was blood typing. They could do that back then. And the killer had type O blood. And wouldn't you know it, guess who else had type O blood? Mr. Ray Crone.
And you know who else has type O blood? 45% of the population.
Yeah.
Isn't it like the most, like the universal or whatever? Like everybody has that?
I believe so. I'm no blood expert, but I believe so. Well, combined with the bite mark comparison and this circumstantial evidence about Kim being romantically interested in him, 2 days later, New Year's Eve, 1991. Imagine sitting in your house getting ready to party and celebrate New Year's Eve. Bang, cops show up and he's arrested. So he described his arrest to us on Forensic Files saying, quote, I hear brakes squealing, doors slamming. I look over and there's a police van unloading with officers all armed, guns pointed at me, telling me to freeze. I was thrown on the ground, handcuffed and taken off. And I was charged with murder, kidnapping and sexual assault.
Imagine that being your last memory of 1991, getting arrested. And not only that, but the way to kick off 1992 is getting arrested for a murder you didn't commit.
You know what's ironic is we're recording this in January. I mean, New Year's Eve was just not that long
ago. Yeah, that's really weird.
It's like, I imagine New Year's Eve is not Ray's favorite celebration because of this.
Yeah, I think after Christmas, I'd be like, I will see you guys on like Martin Luther King Day because that's like the next holiday that I
call me in March. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ray was just 34 years old at the time. He had just bought his first house. He had no criminal record. And this was a good dude. He was in the military. He was smart as hell. He had an incredible background. And I don't even know how to say it. Like, he didn't deserve what happened to him. But now he was facing the death penalty for this crime. So Ray is formally charged on January 8th, 1992, so about a little over a week later. He turned 35 years old that Sunday and was being held without bail in Maricopa County Jail.
And no bail on a capital case. I feel like that's pretty standard, but also terrifying if you're innocent.
If you're innocent is the key word, which he was.
Yeah.
Well, Ray's first trial began on July 30th, 1992, and the prosecution's case hinged on one thing above all else, those jacked up bite marks. And County Attorney Noel Levy told the jury in his opening statement that he'd provided evidence and expert testimony to show Ray Crone was the man who bit Kim Ancona. So defense attorney Jeffrey Jones called the prosecution of Ray Crone a quote-unquote mistake. He pointed out the obvious problems with the case, like, I don't know, no fingerprints, no DNA, no genetic test, no confession, like nothing else except for this stupid bite mark. So Jones attacks the prosecution's forensic expert, a guy named Dr. Raymond Rawson, who, mind you, was from Las Vegas. And using the greatest lawyer burn ever, he called him, quote, a paid expert from the land of 24-hour casinos, end quote.
Let me grab that aloe vera. Dr. Rawson just got burned.
Right. Well, but this guy turns out to be a huge problem, and it's disgusting. However, this guy was essentially one of the big guns. I mean, not only was Ray Rawson a world-renowned dentist, he was also a senator in Nevada, like in the state legislature. At trial, Dr. Rawson, he uses this highfalutin VHS videotape. He photographed bite marks of the wound from Kim Ancona's body, and they were superimposed, kind of like the old school transparencies you would use in school. Mm-hmm. But he did it in a way on this video that it was like so compelling because it would be like overlays that would drop in. And he showed the jury how these teeth lined up. And here's the crucial part. So Dr. Rawson told the jury that the bite mark was 100% perfect match.
Wow.
And he said it was better than a fingerprint, which, come on.
How? Like, how could it be better than a fingerprint? Like, that's not, I feel like, how bite mark evidence works.
No.
Like,
no,
at all.
Not at all. And we will get into the science or lack thereof in a little bit. But to that jury in 1992, hearing a nationally known expert who was a state senator, well-respected, like, to tell you with absolute certainty that Ray Crone's teeth made that bite mark, that's powerful testimony. The prosecution, they also pointed to all of this circumstantial evidence. They contended that Crone had lied to police when he said he didn't know Ancona socially because they produced a witness who said he saw him kissing at a party a few days before the murder. Come on. Didn't happen.
Even if all of this is true that like they were an item or they were hooking up or whatever, that doesn't make him a murderer.
Correct. But obviously police didn't know Ray. So while we're looking at it from 10,000 feet, but Ray would not, if he had a relationship with Kim, he would have told them that day and he would have followed it up by saying, but I didn't kill her. And again, no fingerprints at the scene that match Ray Crone. There's no DNA. This shoe print, a size 9.5, you want to know what size Ray wore? 11s.
Oh, my God.
I know. And the hairs that were found on Kim's body were black. Ray Crone's hair was not. He had dark brown hair. And defense attorney Jones tried to raise all of these inconsistencies, but the bite mark testimony was so powerful, which is ironic to me because now in 2026, it's considered junk science. So, like, if they had the ability to see the future, they would know that this is complete shit.
Right.
Well, regardless, on August 7th, 1992, Ray Crone was convicted of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault. And as the icing on the cake, he was sentenced to death.
Death. Let that sink in. Death for a crime that literally hinged on a bite mark.
And a crime you didn't do.
So scary.
Well, Ray would later describe his reaction, quote, I didn't care. If I was going to be in prison for something I didn't do, you might as well kill me. What was my life? Everything I worked for, stood for, a 35-year-old man was gone, end quote.
That is so depressing.
But also so true.
I understand it, but it's depressing nonetheless.
It is. Well, the press had a freaking field day with this because of his crooked teeth. The very teeth that had supposedly sealed his conviction, Ray Krohn became known throughout Arizona as the Snaggletooth Killer. And he was sent to Arizona's death row and branded a sexual predator and murderer, which we know does not go over well in jail when you add that sexual element to it. While the real killer walked free. That's the part that people don't take into account. Like, yes, we're talking about Ray and Kim. Somebody's still out there who did this.
Mm-hmm.
So in Arizona, all death penalty cases are automatically appealed by the state Supreme Court. And Ray Krohn's appeal would take years to work its way through the system, but would ultimately give him a lifeline. And the key issue in the appeal wasn't whether Ray Krohn was guilty or innocent. It was whether he had received a fair trial the first time around. And the appellate attorneys found a significant problem, though, because remember that video that Dr. Rawson used, the one where he was like superimposing the teeth over the other ones?
That was supposedly like better than a fingerprint, he says.
That's the one. Yeah. Well, it turned out that video had been produced by the prosecution and wasn't disclosed to the defense until like really late in the proceedings. And the defense team argued they had insufficient time to review the tape, like when it was introduced, let alone find their own expert to counter what that video is saying. So in June of 1995, the Arizona Supreme Court issued a unanimous opinion. Justice Frederick Martone wrote that the bite marks on the victim were, quote, critical to the state's case. Without them, there likely would have been no jury submissible case against Krohn, end quote.
This reminds me of last week with Kim, where even the judge was like, I don't think you did it, but the jury says you did, so I have to go with it. Like,
that comes up.
Wild.
Comes up. So the court ruled that the trial judge should have either precluded the prosecutors from using that tape or delayed the start of the trial so that the defense could like prepare its own tape if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, Ray's conviction was overturned and he was granted a new trial. Yes, winning success, right?
We think.
But here's the thing. So remember, that ruling wasn't about his innocence. That's the problem. It was about procedure. And like, Ray Krohn was still under indictment for murder. He'd spent 3 years on death row at this point, and he was now going to have to do it all over again.
That must have been like a relief, but terrifying at the same time.
Yeah, to say the least. Well, Carol Lemming, who's his mom, she spoke to reporters about her son's reaction to his first conviction, saying that during her son's first trial, quote, he told me, don't worry, mom, this is all a mistake. They will find me not guilty because I didn't do it. And she continued, well, he didn't get the proper defense that time, and we have hired a man who will see that he gets a first-rate defense, end quote. And that man was a guy named Christopher Plourd, who was a San Diego lawyer who specialized in really difficult forensic cases. And Plourd would become Ray Krohn's champion. And he's a good dude. He did the Forensic Files and that other show. It was cool to see him again 20 years later.
That is cool.
Yeah, but a really, really good dude.
Maybe we could get him on here.
He would do it. I guarantee it. Guarantee it.
Okay.
So Chris, he was quoted when this whole thing came around again in 96. He told jurors in his opening statement that no witness saw Krohn at the scene of the crime and no physical evidence linked him to it. He told the papers, quote, Mr. Krohn's life hangs in the balance over a bite mark from an expert who came to a 100% different conclusion from that of the state's experts, end quote.
So this time he's bringing his own bite mark people, like his own experts.
Not just his own experts, like a team of mega all-stars.
Wow.
And before I tell you about this lineup, I want to drop a little history lesson on you because I can't wait for you to see how I bring this all together. This is...
Oh, boy.
Yes. So we talk about junk science and bite marks 100% fall into that category. And the origin of bite mark analysis began in 1954 with a piece of cheese in a small Texas town. So a dentist had testified that a bite mark in this cheese left behind at a grocery store had been robbed. It matched the teeth of some drunken man. They found him with 13 stolen silver dollars, and the man was convicted. So that's the history of bite marks because of a piece of cheese.
Wow, a piece of cheese.
Well, the first court case involving a bite mark on a person didn't come until two decades later in 1974, also in Texas, when two dentists testified that a man's teeth matched a bite mark on a murder victim. And I'm not going into that's why I'm generalizing that case. But although the defense attorney fought the admissibility of the evidence, a court ruled that it should be allowed because it had been used in 1954 in that hunk of cheese.
Wow.
But it wasn't until 1979 in Florida when bite mark analysis came into the national spotlight. And you want to take a guess at whose trial that happened?
Mr. Theodore Bundy.
Mr. Ted Bundy, yes. So on the night Bundy went on a killing spree that left two young women dead and three others seriously wounded, he savagely bit one of those victims who we covered all those months ago, Lisa Levy. And a forensic dentist, Dr. Richard Suveron, testified at Bundy's trial that this unusual mangled teeth that Bundy had were a match to the wounds on Lisa Levy. So Bundy was found guilty and executed, and those bite marks were considered a key piece of physical evidence against him, mainly thanks to Richard Suveron's testimony. And you want to know where Richard Suveron testified? At the 1996 trial of Ray Crone. How do you like that tie-in?
That is wild. Like,
right?
And I know bite mark analysis is trash, but as a juror, if they bring in a guy that hammered the final nail in Ted Bundy's proverbial coffin, like, I would probably believe every word he said. And
yeah,
I'm not necessarily proud of that because it's not always the right thing to do, but I mean, he got the biggest fish, literally. Like, why would you not listen to him?
Most certainly. And that's the kind of guy that Ray Crone needed in his corner to defend himself against Senator Dennis Guy.
Yeah.
So Suveron is on his team. And then also a dentist by the name of Norman Sperber, who went by Skip. And he was a great man who, again, I mentioned the forensic files. We didn't have all this cool science that we have today. So it was a lot of trace evidence, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So we did teeth a lot. And Skip Sperber, I had worked with two, three, four times on various episodes. But he was the president of the American Academy of Forensic Odontologists. So this wasn't some hired gun. This was like one of the most respected experts in the field.
Wow.
So now we got this team of like all-star dentists going over all the bite mark evidence, while other hired forensic analysts were poring over the hairs found on Kim Ancona's body. And remember, the prosecution had basically ignored those hairs completely because of this bite mark. But it turned out those hairs were, I can't say the word, basically means the hair belongs to someone of Native American or Asian descent. An outdated term was used to describe it. And it's a scientific term, we just don't say it. But here's the thing. Ray Crone is neither Asian nor Native American, so WTF.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant piece of evidence that was just totally like steamrolled over. They were like, forget it.
Ignored. Completely ignored. It gets better, just wait. So the shoe print found on the kitchen floor, size 9.5. Again, Ray Crone wore an 11. So like a full size and a half different. Here's where things get really interesting. So Skip Sperber, he told Chris Plourd, the attorney, that he'd actually seen this evidence before. And it had been sent to him before the trial. And a colleague in the prosecutor's office had asked him to take a look at it.
So the prosecution's own consultant had seen this evidence before the first trial.
Yes, right? And so Dr. Sperber had told his colleague that the bite mark evidence was exceptionally weak. He said on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being like very clear, this is a perfect match, he would have rated this around a 3 or 4, like on the lower end of the spectrum.
So they friggin' knew before the first trial that their star evidence was weak, and they just went on with it anyway. That is some straight ego shit.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you something later in this story that is going to make your blood boil. So according to Dr. Sperber, he explained why the bite mark evidence was so problematic. Because a good bite mark, and when you say good bite mark, it's not, we're talking about like reliability of matching to a suspect. So it showed clear impressions from multiple teeth. And you can see the relationships between those teeth clearly. And the bite wound on Kim Ancona's body were, they had very few distinctive markings. Like the biggest thing was this front tooth that was like out of line from the next one. That was the biggest thing. But other than that, like looked like a lot of people's teeth. So Dr. Sperber used a kind of a low tech, but time tested method to compare this evidence. So he takes a cast of Ray Crone's teeth that made a styrofoam impression and then traced the teeth patterns onto a transparency. And he placed that overlay and over the top of the bite marks on Kim's body and found some critical differences. Although both Ray Crone and the bite mark showed a left front tooth that was jutting forward, Ray Crone does not have any separation between his front teeth. It's just they were jacked up, but there was no space between them.
Right.
And the bite mark on Kim's body shows an obvious separation between those teeth. So for Skip Sperber, the conclusion was clear. He told papers that, quote, if it's a good bite, it will really jump out at you, and you will see immediate similarities. In the Crone case, there were no similarities. I can positively exclude Ray Crone as being the biter, end quote.
Right there.
And to bolster these findings of Sperber, he had three other people on his team, three other dentists, board certified, by the way, who all reviewed his work and testified to the exact same thing, that Ray did not make these bites.
Wow.
But here's where we get into the story that's going to make you lose your mind. And I apologize in advance because the prosecution brought back Dr. Raymond Rawson. And Rawson testified once again There was no doubt in his mind that that bite mark was made by Ray Krohn. So what does that mean? It means the jury has to choose between four respected experts saying Ray Krohn didn't do it and one expert saying he did. And the jury sides with, once again, Dr. Raymond Rawson, senator from Nevada.
Are you kidding me? I don't get it.
I'm just getting started. On April 12, 1996, a second jury found Ray Krohn guilty again. And during 3 days of deliberation, the jury of 10 women and 2 men agreed with the prosecution's dental experts that it was Ray Krohn's teeth that bit Kim Ancona's left breast at the time of her death or immediately after. And at the time, Ray Krohn told the Arizona Republic, quote, "I was not there that night. I didn't kill Kim Ancona. The verdict pretty much rules out any faith I have in truth and justice," end quote.
Absolutely. You get where he's coming from. Like, I can't imagine 2 trials, 2 convictions, and it's all based on the same crappy-ass questionable evidence. Like, I wish we could talk to the jurors and be like, what were you smoking that day? Like, what?
I think maybe because it was already established, it's already what put him behind bars to begin with. So now it's almost like you don't watch football, but there's you can now challenge calls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be something called clear and conclusive evidence that the call that they called on the field didn't happen. And if they don't see that, even if it looks like, yeah, maybe it could go the other way, they stick with their original ruling. And I feel like this is like a prehistoric version of that.
I almost feel like it's like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like, kind of thing.
They were like, well, this was good enough to convict him. So
yeah, it's fine.
Well, and there was one silver lining because the jury decided that the murder was not premeditated. They believe that Ancona was slain while her attacker was in the process of trying to kidnap her, which I'm not sure where they came to that, but it became more difficult for prosecutors then to pursue the death penalty without that motivation. So sentencing was set for later that year.
But he might not get the death penalty. Like, it might just be life in prison this time.
Correct.
Right?
Absolutely. Okay. So Judge James McDougall ultimately sentences Ray Krohn to life in prison. And here's what's remarkable. So even the judge had doubts. This McDougall, he said at sentencing, quote, "This is one of those cases that will haunt me for the rest of my life, whether I did the right thing," end quote.
Wow. Even the judge wasn't sure that he was like sentencing the right person.
Isn't that nuts?
And again, we saw it last week. Like, that's wild.
But he sentences him anyway. And Ray Krohn is now 39 years old, sent to prison for the rest of his natural life. I mean, at least he's off death row, but still.
Right.
So his mother, Carolyn, and his stepfather, Jim Lemming, had basically liquidated all of their assets to defend him. They spent over $300,000 fighting for Ray's freedom. And they'd published a newsletter subtitled "The Story of an Innocent Man on Arizona's Death Row."
Wow.
But none of it mattered. And Ray was going back to prison. And that's where he would remain until science finally caught up with justice. And let's be clear, the entire time that Ray was in jail, he was screaming from the rooftops his innocence. And he would appear in several articles saying things to the effect of, like, "I don't care how many dentists say I made that bite mark. I didn't do it."
Except it was just one douchey dentist.
Exactly. But you see where he's coming from. Like, he knows he wasn't there, and there's no other defense needed. I don't need to say, like, well, maybe My alibi was a little shaky. He's like, "I wasn't there. I didn't do it. I don't know what else to tell you."
Anyone's going to say that I wasn't there. I didn't. You know what I mean? Like, it's so hard.
But from day one, he reacted like an innocent man, and he was railroaded.
Yeah.
But in 2001, Arizona became one of the first states in the country to pass this new law that would end up saving Ray's life.
Mm-hmm.
So it allowed convicted offenders to access the evidence in post-conviction DNA testing. This was huge because it meant that inmates who maintained their innocence could petition to have evidence from their case retested. And as we know, DNA technology, it had improved dramatically since 1991.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Krohn's new attorney, Alan Simpson, he filed a petition in the Maricopa County Superior Court to have the evidence tested again. And his argument was simple. If Ray Krohn is innocent, the DNA will show you that he was innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And the court absolutely agreed with this. So Krohn's defense team, they asked the state of Arizona to test every piece of Kim Ancona's clothing for DNA testing. That blouse I was talking about that was all torn up, it had knife marks and chew marks in it. It had already been tested back in 1991, and those results were inconclusive, again, because of the infancy of the science.
Yeah.
But there were small bloodstains on Kim's jeans and her underwear that hadn't been analyzed. And the prosecution had always assumed that the blood belonged to Kim herself. Because again, early stage.
Well, if they assumed it, that's just totally legit. No, we've already gone over this. Gut feelings are not evidence.
They don't count. Right. So these jeans in the underwear were sent to Phoenix Police Department's Laboratory Services Bureau for new DNA testing. And I'm sure Ray's like, great. Same people that took care of the evidence last time.
Yeah.
So the results come back in March of 2002. And the blood on the pants was not Kim Ancona's. And it was not Ray Crone's. Just like Ray's been trying to tell him. Well, Alan Simpson, he told the Arizona Republic, quote, "We're excited to say the least. If he's not freed, at the very worst, he could get another trial," end quote. But they weren't done. So scientists enter this new DNA profile into CODIS, which I don't need to explain what that is to you guys. But even at the time contained the genetic profiles of more than like a million convicted criminals from across the country. Profile after profile was checked and cross-referenced, and they get a hit.
Yay!
Well, the DNA matches 36-year-old Kenneth Phillips. So Phillips was a Native American. And remember those hairs that were found on Kim Ancona's body? Mm-hmm. And at the time of the DNA match, he was already in prison for child molestation.
So he's already in prison for another crime while Ray Crone was sitting there convicted of his crime. Like,
isn't that
if
insane?
If he's already there, why wouldn't he say, like, I know why he wouldn't say something, but it's like,
yeah, because child molestation, obviously one crime gets you the death penalty. The other gets you a couple years in prison. So I get it. But it gets significantly worse. So at the time of Kim Ancona's murder, Kenneth Phillips lived just 600 yards away from the CBS lounge. It's crazy to see these cases end after all these years. And it turns out to be somebody that was literally right under their nose. So the investigation did move quickly and police questioned Phillips. What he told them was chilling. So Phillips had said that on the morning after Kim's murder, he awoke from an alcoholic blackout to find his hands covered in blood. And when he heard the news about the murder on TV, he like wondered if he killed Kim Ancona.
He wondered? Like, how do you not know if you killed someone?
Don't even get me started. Remember we talked about this weeks ago about how these guys all black out? Like, what was his name? Anthony Allen Shore? I blacked out.
Yeah, I call it selective amnesia.
Get out of here. So here's where the evidence really starts piling up. So investigators, they go back and they compare Phillips' fingerprints to those unknown prints that were found in the men's restroom where Kim was murdered. And surprise, surprise, they are an exact match. The same fingerprints that had been sitting in evidence since 1991. Oh, and Phillips' shoe size? Want to take a guess?
9.5?
9.5. The exact same size of the print found on the kitchen floor. And then there was that pesky bite mark. He basically was asked to bite down on some styrofoam and it showed the left front protruding just from the rest of the teeth, just a little bit, just like the wound on Kim Ancona's body. And also just like Ray Crone's teeth, which what are the odds that a murder happens and the person who does it has the same bite pattern as you?
That's why we always talk about these little coincidences that have to happen.
Oh. Right. Right. But here, get this. So this is important. So Phillips also had that separation between his front teeth, just like the bite mark showed that Ray didn't have, meaning the bite mark that convicted Ray Crone actually matched Kenneth Phillips better than it matched Ray Crone.
God damn. I hope that dentist thinks about this every damn day. They should make him sit in jail for 10 years.
I don't know. He's still around. He's old. He's in his 80s now. Shit.
I said it.
Well, wow. There you go.
There you go.
Melissa's review. 1 star. Would not recommend.
That's my Yelp review on this dude.
Well, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office under Rick Romley announced that they were investigating the case. He said the new evidence not only vindicates Crone, but points directly at Kenneth Phillips, which is the big difference between this story and the last two we told, where they rule one guy out, but they don't have someone else to point to.
Right.
And they're just open. Yeah. So the prosecution announced that they would move to vacate Crone's conviction and release him pending a hearing to dismiss those charges. So it's not just like, you know what? We were wrong. You get out. Bye. There's like more legal hurdles. Yeah. So it's like not there's over. It's over, but it's not.
After 10 years, they're finally admitting that they were wrong, that they screwed up and they got the wrong guy.
But at least they were admitting it finally.
Yeah.
And honestly, Romley held nothing back. He said at an April 8th, 2002 press conference, quote, "Ray Crone deserves an apology from us. That's for sure. A mistake was made here. What do you say to him? An injustice was done and we will try to do better and we're sorry," end quote. To which
What do you say?
You can't, there's nothing you can say, but I do appreciate that a public apology was made.
Yes. agree.
So with that, Ray Krohn walks out of an Arizona state prison in Yuma after serving 10 years and facing the death penalty for a murder that he did not commit. Wow. And after all this, Krohn, he refused to place blame on anybody for this decade behind bars, which says so much about the guy that he is.
Oh, he's so much of a better person than like I am.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, I matter at that piece of shit Dennis, and I think he was like...
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're right, just because Ray just has an incredible outlook on life, despite everything that happened to him. Like, he never once pointed the finger at anybody, only that an injustice had happened.
So what happened next? Did they get Phillips?
Oh, absolutely they did.
Good.
So, yeah, on April 24th, 2002, it was just over 2 weeks after Krohn's release, Rick Romley again, he filed the murder and sexual assault charges against Kenneth Phillips. And prosecutors also filed to dismiss all the charges against Ray Krohn with prejudice, meaning they could never, ever be refiled.
Good.
And here's one of the most kind of moving parts of this story for me. So this was the first time that Ray Krohn had seen Kim Ancona's mother, Patricia Gassman, since he was last sentenced. And after both trials, Gassman had asked the court to give Krohn the death penalty, which I can't blame her one bit.
Oh, that's your child. Like, of course.
Yeah, and you're being told this is the guy who did it. Like, she doesn't know. She's this little tiny woman. She has no idea.
Right. And she's being, and again, this goes back to, you're supposed to trust the police. They're telling you something. You're supposed to believe it, and you're going to.
Absolutely. Well, after that final hearing, Gassman hugs Ray Krohn and apologized, and she was crying. And she told reporters, quote, "I told him I had to do what I did. It wasn't about hate. I just had questions why," end quote.
That takes a lot of grace from both of them, I think.
It does. It does. But I think she knew. I think she could see the writing on the wall and knew this wasn't the guy.
Yeah.
But when released, Krohn became the 100th prisoner nationwide to be exonerated by DNA since 1989, and only the second in Arizona. So it was pretty monumental.
Wow.
And Ray Krohn's mother, Carol Lemming, who we talked about earlier, she spoke about the day that she learned her son was getting out. And I know I'm giving you a lot of quotes, but I don't think there's a better way, again, to explain people's mindset in the time. So Lemming said, quote, "My God, I hope he becomes a millionaire because I can't give him those 10 and a half years back if it's true. I had to believe what I was told and what was proved to me. But I have served that sentence with him. Now I can cry," end quote.
Aww. And she's right. Like, yeah. He deserves to be a bajillionaire.
And she, to make this clear, she and everyone in Ray's inner circle had his back the entire time. They knew Ray. They knew he had nothing to do with this. So it wasn't a question like he was alienated from everyone he loved. They were all in his corner for all 10 years.
Wow.
So after his release, Ray Krohn returns to his mother's home in Pennsylvania, not terribly far from us, Dover, York area.
Mm-hmm.
And the town welcomed him home with open arms. There's this cool picture. It was like, "Welcome home, Ray." It was written on a piece of plywood, like in spray paint. Probably that's all they had.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so Pennsylvania. It's something I would do. It's like free washer. Just put it at the end of my driveway. That's what it reminded me of. And Ray walks up to the house. There's balloons and everything. And he was hugged by friends and family. And he later stopped at the home of his sister, Amy Wilkinson. And he held his 21-month-old niece, Hannah Ray, whose Ray, her middle name, actually came from Ray's name.
Oh, and that's cool.
Isn't that cool? Yeah. And he hugged 13-year-old Beth and 14-year-old Abby. They were other nieces who he'd never met. And he gave his 88-year-old grandma, Hazel Latshaw, a kiss and a hug.
Can you imagine meeting family members for the first time after like a decade in prison?
Craziness.
You've missed so much.
It was literally like starting all over, like from scratch.
He missed, I feel like, such an intricate part of life with the internet coming about and cell phones becoming like everybody has one. And do you know what I mean? Like, when he went in, people probably only had the Zach Morris big phones.
Yeah.
When he
yeah.
came out, everyone's got one in their pocket.
Like, I was just talking, I was telling Brenda about this case the other day, just because Ray was coming up and we were telling, and that's what we were talking about. Like, the technology that so much happens in 10 years, especially during that time. So like, he obviously,
especially during that time.
Right. But she brought up the fact that like, he at least didn't miss the smartphone generation. Cause could you imagine, let's say you go into prison in 1997 and you come out and everything you ever need is in your pocket on this. You're probably like, what?
Well, Michelle Knight talked about that.
The same exact thing. Yep.
Yeah, like she didn't know how to use a smartphone because when she was abducted, they didn't have smartphones.
Yeah. And just technology in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this is literally, it cracked me up because it gives you a glimpse into Ray's personality. So he said that his tan would likely suffer in Eastern PA because he had moved out there. He was a young guy. He was going out there to have some fun in the sun. So he might consider moving back. And his sister was like, how about you just go to a tanning salon?
Yeah, I'll spray you, Ray. I got, exactly. Like, we got this.
You're not going back to Arizona.
No.
Well, while rebuilding his life after this wrongful conviction, it was not easy. And Ray came back with nothing. When he was released, his house in Phoenix was gone. All of his money was gone. Bank account liquidated. His mom and stepfather had mortgaged their house to pay for his defense. Remember I said $300,000.
Yeah.
And a cousin of Ray, his name was Jim Ricks, he had never met, contributed $100,000. So, but that just shows you the financial devastation was, how it impacted him. It was enormous, his whole family. Not only did he lose these 10 years, he was essentially broke.
Yeah, of course. And he also hadn't been making any money in the last 10 years. Like,
there's that.
It's not just that they took so many years from your life. It's just like you missed so many things.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Ray files this federal lawsuit in April of 2003 seeking $100 million from the Maricopa County Attorney Office and Phoenix Police. And to that, I say that made me laugh because have you ever seen Austin Powers, the first one, International Man of Mystery? He's like, I want $100 million, like, because it was some outrageous number. And they're like,
bah! Yes.
And they're just laughing in his face. But you know what? I applaud that. Ray, shoot for the moon, man. You deserve every damn penny of that $100 million.
Every penny.
Yes. Well, the lawsuit claimed that the verdict was a result of police incompetence, fraud, misconduct by the prosecutors, and perjury by the witnesses, which is 100% true.
Yeah.
And it included 25 allegations, including conspiracy, false imprisonment, tampering with evidence, cruel and unusual punishment, negligence, and defamation. And I know, again, $100 million sounds like an absurd amount, but what kind of price can you put on 10 years of your life and your tarnished reputation? So I think $100 million sounds like a nice round number to make it all better.
I don't even think that's enough. You missed 10 years of your freaking life. Like,
yeah,
he deserves so much more than that. He deserves a time machine to go back.
Exactly. Well, he did not get what he was asking for, but and frankly, what he deserved. But in April of 2005, Maricopa County did agree to pay Ray Krohn a total of $4.4 million in restitution. Ray said some of the money would go to his parents who spent all that money mortgaging their home.
Right.
And also he owed around $500,000 in attorney fees. Like Richard Suveron clearing Ted or convicting Ted Bundy, not cheap.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
So after like all was said and done, he walked away with about $3.5 million for 10 years of his life, which came out to like $350,000 per year for being wrongfully convicted and nearly executed, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
And neither the city nor the county attorney admitted any wrongdoing in the settling, but Ray said he was glad it was over and that he would never have to pay for another lawyer ever again.
Yeah.
And then something happened that was kind of unexpected, something that would help Ray Krohn reclaim his identity. If you recall, for over a decade, Ray Krohn had been defined by his teeth. Prosecutors, the media, everybody labeled him the snaggletooth killer. His teeth became his prison, like metaphorically and literally.
Yeah.
Then ABC comes calling.
As in like the TV channel?
As in the TV channel, yeah. So in November of 2004, it was announced that Ray Krohn would be appearing on ABC's reality show Extreme Makeover. And the show's producer said Krohn was the perfect candidate because they were looking for someone whose looks deeply and negatively affected their lives. And I think that's a perfect representation. And get this. So his attorney, Chris Plourd, the man who had fought so hard for him during his second trial, and like working on getting those DNA tests through, he flew to Krohn's home during the weekend to surprise him with the news that he was chosen for Extreme Makeover.
Aw, that's so sweet.
It is. So ABC flies Ray to LA, where he would spend nearly 2 months in the Hollywood Hills, in this mansion, recovering from the surgery of what they were going to do to his face and meeting a fitness trainer and a nutritionist. So this wasn't just a teeth thing. It was a full body makeover.
It's like all out. Yeah.
He had undergone extensive dental work, including new porcelain veneers, which at the time were kind of the latest in tooth replacement. And Ray also had some pretty bad acne scars. So dermatologists worked with him simultaneously to kind of smooth out those pockmarks. He had a hair transplant, an eye lift, a nose job, and liposuction on his cheeks. And when you met him, you're going to laugh because he's like not that guy. But I think for this, it was important to him. And after the makeover, Ray Krohn steps out with an entirely new look, complete with two straight rows of pearly whites. Look like chiclets in there. It's like, man, good for you.
I love this so much. It's like his glow up.
It is. Like 100%.
And it really does work with this, like, this is how we got our theme, guys. Like, literally starting fresh.
Yes. Right. This is as fresh start as it gets.
Yes.
So one thing before we wrap this up. So I want to check in on Kenneth Phillips, the man whose DNA was actually found at the crime scene. And this is where the story gets complicated and kind of frustrating. So remember, Phillips was charged with murder and sexual assault in April of 2002. Took over 4 years. And on August 18th, 2006, a judge finally accepted a plea deal in the case. So Phillips, who was then 40, he pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and sexual assault in the stabbing death of Kim Ancona. And Judge Linda Akers of Maricopa County Superior Court, she sentences Phillips to life in prison with no possibility of release for 25 years. And she added a consecutive 28-year prison term for the sexual assault. And in exchange for Phillips' guilty plea, prosecutors dropped their request for the death penalty.
So the guy who actually committed this murder and killed Kim and took her away from her children and loved ones gets life in prison, while Ray, who did nothing wrong, was sentenced to death.
Isn't that so f***ed? To be
honest. Make that make sense.
Make it make sense.
And what happened with all the bite mark experts, like the ones who swore up and down, he definitely did it. That guy.
That's what I wanted to tell you about. So this is where things get so freaking frustrating. So Richard Suveron, remember the Bundy guy? So he was one of the defense experts. He drops this bombshell. So he said he had sat next to Ray Rawson, who was that expert who provided that videotape that everybody was so wowed by. It was at some kind of scientific conference. And during that conversation, Suveron said that Rawson admitted he knew he was wrong about the bite mark evidence. His comment to me was, "I'm in too deep." He knew he was wrong, but he already committed. And if that isn't a scary thing, I don't know what is. End quote.
So the prosecution's star witness, he knew he was wrong, and yet he stuck to it. See, earlier when I said he's a piece of shit, like, come at me and tell me he's not.
That's it's hard to ignore the if that story is true. I don't know. Well, according to Suveron, yes, Suveron said he urged Rawson to change his position because he hated seeing Rawson get sucked into something like that. Like, none of us are above making mistakes, but I feel it's important how you deal with those mistakes. And Rawson clearly took the path of least resistance at the expense of a man's life. And that's where this wasn't like, yeah, I stole something and I didn't want to say anything. This is like a man's life.
That's why I said he should go to prison for 10 years. Like, I wholeheartedly believe that.
Is so corrupt.
It's so corrupt.
Well, through a spokesperson, Dr. Rawson has denied that that conversation ever took place. But the damage was already done, though. And Crone's case became kind of a landmark example of the dangers of unreliable forensic junk science, as it's like bite mark, as it's been labeled. And let's call it like it is. So Ray's case didn't just free one innocent man. It helped change the conversation about forensic science in America. Forensic odontologists who reviewed the case agreed that the fundamental problem was Dr. Rawson telling jurors that the bite mark could match just like fingerprints. Remember, I stressed, he said it was a 100% perfect match, just like fingerprints, because it's simply not true. The best a forensic dentist can give is reasonable certainty, and there's always a remote possibility that there's someone else that has teeth similar to Ray, and this is why you're seeing all of this. That's what happened.
I feel like bite mark evidence should be used to exclude suspects, but not identify them.
Right. Absolutely. Well, that's the lesson that the forensic community took away from this. Like, bite mark analysis is more opinion than fact. And it should always be made clear to jurors that when such evidence is introduced, that that's what they keep in mind as they're looking at it.
Yeah.
Well, Ray himself became an advocate against the death penalty, which I understand why. He's led marches, he even met with legislators in hopes of, like, ending capital punishment as we know it. And for Ray, it's important to know it's not about the money. Like, he wants to get the word out. He wants to be proactive and, like, make his family and friends proud, which he has always done. I don't think that's ever going to be an issue. And at one point he said, quote, "It's not about what I did in the last 10 years. Maybe it's about what I have to do for the next 10 years. End quote.
He is such an incredible man, and that is such a beautiful perspective. Like, instead of, like, bitterness, he's choosing purpose, and that's incredible.
Absolutely. Well, he even served on the Commission of Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons and advocating for reform. And his case gained national attention because he was one of the first, and at that point, like I said, the 100th person since 19-whatever to be set free after having been sentenced to death, exonerated, freed, thanks to DNA evidence.
Right.
So where are we today? That's the million-dollar question. So Ray is now in his 60s. He's moved to Tennessee, where he lives among the Great Smoky Mountains. That snaggletooth killer nickname is long gone, replaced by an identity that he chose himself. Wrongful conviction survivor, advocate, and symbol of both the failures and the potential for redemption in our justice system. And I checked on our old pal Kenneth Phillips the other day, and he's still serving life in prison for Kim Ancona's murder. He looks the exact same, just grayer. Like, ugh. When you see this guy, it's like, and it's the same picture from 91, just grayer.
I hope every day is the worst day possible.
Agreed. Well, and what about Kim Ancona? So as we see in most of these stories, she seems to get kind of lost behind the headlines. And man, I wish I could have found more information on her. We even had the almighty Shannon digging behind the scenes, and she had trouble too.
Yeah.
It sounded like she was wonderful. And what we do know is that she was a 36-year-old mother of three whose life was cut short in the most brutal way imaginable. Like, for over a decade, her family believed her killer was behind bars, and they advocated for his execution, which was Ray. And then they learned the truth that an innocent man had been convicted, all while this monster Kenneth Phillips walked free.
This case really does have it all. Like, it's got this flawed forensic science. It's got the dangers of expert testimony. We have, obviously, the problems with our death penalty system and justice system in general. And ultimately, just goes to show, yet again, why DNA is so incredibly amazing.
It's the best. DNA will either free you or put you in jail. I mean, it's the ultimate be-all end-all. So I am proud to say that I raise a friend of mine. I'm excited to bring you guys his perspective, and it's going to be neat to catch up after all these years. Like, the emails we exchange are just more procedural, like, here's when you'll be on, here's what you need, StreamYard, you need this, that. But it's going to be nice to just sit down and have a conversation with this man who is a wonderful human being.
That's going to be a really good episode. I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, a heartbreaking example of the justice system failures. But if we're teaching you nothing else on this, it's not to believe everything you hear.
Except us. Believe us.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that either.
Well, maybe not.
Guys, if this case resonates with you anyway, please consider supporting organizations like the Innocence Project, which work to exonerate wrongfully convicted individuals through DNA testing. And if you haven't already, go back and listen to our episode on Carol Armstrong and Randy Arledge, which is another heartbreaking example of how our justice system can fail the innocent.
And last week's case with Kim and Ozzie Condi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no shortage of these stories.
No, there's definitely not.
Which sucks.
Right. Anyway, so I heard a rumor, my friend, that you got a response from your biggest idol.
Oh my God. So guys, remember for my birthday, Ed made me the shirt with Colleen Fitzpatrick, who is the godmother of DNA, the DNA duchess, if you will. The
Duchess of DNA.
Exactly. I had messaged her a couple months back and I was like, I'm your number one fan. Like,
which is the stalkeriest behavior.
Oh, my, like, I read it afterwards and like my note was unhinged. I told her that, like, you know how Taylor Swift has the Swifties? I was like, we should have the Fitzies for Colleen Fitzpatrick. And she like thought that was a hoot. And then I just sent her a picture of the t-shirt that Ed made me. And she was like, oh my God, is that me? Like, she literally
and where do
wrote
I get
that.
One?
Exactly. Yeah, right. No, she did not say that, but she was like, she thought it was hilarious.
That's
and
cool.
She thanked us for making her 10 years younger and 10 years thinner on the t-shirt.
Well, I'm glad she didn't block you. I'm glad that I think what you should do is just announce that she's going to be a guest long before you even ask her to be. And we'll.
Oh, yeah.
That'll put those vibes into the air.
Yeah, we'll manifest it.
If I were her, I would not go anywhere within 10 feet of you.
She's so cool. Like, what she does is so freaking cool. Like, she's so incredibly intelligent, which I'm already in awe of. Like, and just what she's done with her life and, like, all the schooling she's had. Like, I just think that's so incredible. Whereas, like, we worship people who run around on the court for a couple hours, but, like, we don't worship people who, like, use their brains and help humanity.
Can she dunk a basketball?
No, but does that save lives? No.
Well, I think it's super cool that, and that's exactly what Colleen's response to you was exactly what we are. Like, there's a seriousness. She puts a lot of professionalism into her work, but look how like fun and sassy she can be. We make her a shirt that says Fitzy on it and she laughs at it. and like has a good time with it. And it's like not about the victim. It's not about any case. It's just we're having fun while we're telling you serious things. So I feel like Colleen, it would be a good friend.
Well, and I think you need to not make light of things, but you have to have some sort of release because
1,000%.
I've noticed with myself, like I listen to a lot of true crime and there are days where I'm like, I need a break. And like the other day I put on like 90s mix in the morning when I was getting ready for work instead of a true crime.
Right. And when you're like, I've been immersed in this for two decades of my, almost a quarter century. Like it's just, you need it. And I feel like I've earned the right to do it. So.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I guess before we go, just the usual reminders, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on our socials. We are at Murder Unscripted on Facebook, TikTok, Insta, and Blue Sky, which I always laugh when I say that just because I think it's
funny.
Don't
even say it.
I know.
Reddit is more important.
Yeah, we do have a Reddit, so check us out on there. Ed and I go in and comment a lot, and Shannon's on there, and it is really fun. Mm-hmm. So check us out there. And again, we do have a Patreon. There's four different tiers that you can be a part of, so you can kind of choose. And right now, there are our January episodes out, which is a full-length episode and a mini-sode.
Absolutely.
And like I said, when we get done with this, I'm going to go put our milkshake recipes on the Patreon.
You want to go behind the scenes of the behind the scenes? This is where you find it on Patreon.
Yes. Yes. It's so true. We got a little unhinged last night.
Yeah.
My head hurts a little. I need to go lay down.
Take a nap.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I already took one this morning. I was up and then fell back asleep. But
Melissa took a morning nap. We were supposed to record. I'm like, where are you? She's like, oh, I'm asleep.
I need my like mid-morning snooze.
I need less milkshakes today.
Yeah, no milkshakes for a little while.
Oof.
Well, on that note, we hope you'll tune in next week, our interview with Ray. So get excited for that. And until then, as always, we hope you stay safe, stay hydrated, get your big ass water bottle.
Yes.
And above all, remember that perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But they may be named Kenneth Phillips.
Or maybe they're dentists.
Or maybe they're dentists. Yeah.